This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U-Mobile.
Good morning, this is The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Gunnison. Sime W Oils is the downstream arm of Sime W Plantations, the world's largest palm oil plantation company by planted area. Last year on The Breakfast Grill, we talked about Sime W Oils' ambitious plans to play a bigger part in contributing to the overall group's bottom line. But a year later, has that been derailed by the pandemic and a ban from the US Customs and Border Protection? To find out, I'm speaking with Haris Arshad, Managing Director of Sime W Oils. Haris, welcome to The Breakfast Grill.
Good morning, Roshan. It's good to be back and thank you for having me.
So, Haris, let's start off with the ban here. The US CBP has detained palm oil and products containing palm oil specifically produced by Sime W Plantations and its subsidiaries following allegations of forced labor. Now, last week when we spoke to you over the phone, you claimed the allegations leading to the order were false, noting that among Sime's 88,000 employees, there are always a few bad apples. Why are you so confident that there are only a few bad apples here?
Yeah, so just to expand a bit on the WRO portion, the ban is actually imposed on Sime W plantation operations in Malaysia only. So it doesn't cover products that's produced out of Indonesia, out of Thailand, or out of Papua New Guinea and Solomon Islands. So I just want to make that clear. So in with regards to your question, why or how are we so confident? You know, we have been in this business for over 100 years, and we've spent a lot of resources and done a lot of things to sort of improve our operation. As you know, Sime W Plantation is a founding member of the RSPO, and 100% of our operations are certified sustainable by the RSPO, where we go through a certification process and an annual audit. To ensure that we comply with the criteria to be certified as sustainable. And one of those criteria includes exploitation. And given that RSPO itself have given us a clean bill of health across our operations, this is why we were quite shocked when the USCBP came up with the withholding order.
So I guess, Haris, this then puts the RSPO in sort of like a bit of a conflict here with the CBP, right? Because at the end of the day, your certification does come from the RSPO, but the CBP is, I guess, acting on this petition from Liberty Shared. Have you gotten any updates from the CBP about this, about the findings that Liberty Shared had?
Unfortunately, no. Having said that, we do engage with them regularly. We have appointed a legal firm to help us connect with the USCBP out of Washington, D.C. And to be fair, the process is such that whatever that we feed into the USCBP, they are not obliged to actually give anything back to us. But that does not suggest that they're not doing anything about it, right? So the approach here is for us to continue to engage with the USCBP. In fact, the moment that we were told of this risk of WRO being imposed, we submitted a 500-page document to the USCBP detailing all of the practices that we do in Malaysia and across our operation to sort of allay and to assure them that none of this is actually systemic. So that is done. We are going to take steps to ensure that the USCBP will be kept appraised of all the things that we are doing, not to say that there's something wrong with the operation, just to give more assurance and evidence that things are actually running as normal, and there's no supposedly this allegation of human rights abuses in our operation.
Right, because this end of the day, it's basically they're citing one of the conditions from the 11 ILO factors of forced labor, right? That's where this is coming from. And when we take a look at this, Haris, we've seen Malaysia has come under some scrutiny from the, when we take a look at the rubber glove makers, for example, for labor practices. How is the audit process on your side that you're so confident that you're not running foul of this?
Well, of course, this is not just us doing our own audit and review. We have worked with NGOs in the past that has actually done an assessment of our practices pertaining to workers and human rights. And this is alongside the RSPO certification. And we have taken a lot of improvement steps along the way. And of course, I think to say that there is a systemic problem in our operation is simply false. Otherwise, we would have been called out. And you know, Roshan, we now live in a world where everything is transparent. Everybody carries a smartphone. Anybody can actually take a video. And if these things do happen, I'm very sure it will be called out and we'll be the first to know. So the fact that allegations were made and these allegations remain elusive to us, we don't know what they are. And we actually have reached out to Liberty Shed and the investigator here in Malaysia who raised this issue. Nothing specifics have come out. And we are concerned because this is a serious allegation around human rights abuses. If abuses are happening in SDP, we need to take action. Otherwise, these people who have been abused are at risk. Now, if you say that these things are happening, you better tell us or tell the police or tell anybody so that it can be rectified. Now, not telling us exactly what's happening, aren't you then putting these people at risk? That's where we're a bit very concerned.
Now, there's going to be some of this reputational impact, especially since ESG and sustainability has been such a big part of Siam Dabi Plantation's story in recent years. Is there any concern at all that this ban or even the reputational risk here could be extended over to the EU and Europe?
Of course, there is a concern here, Roshan. And what we want to ensure is that it doesn't escalate. Because the problem here is not just about us. It's not just about Siam Dabi Plantation. But it will also affect the entire industry and Malaysia in particular. And to all those companies that are trying hard to do the right thing. And we've always been acknowledged as a trusted company. And as I said, we've always tried to do the right thing. And of course, there are pockets in our operations that could be questioned, but certainly it's not systemic. And if we don't address this problem as SDP, this could then may lead into a wider industrial problem. And certainly as a country, we cannot afford that.
Have you heard from any of your customers about maybe holding off orders or any cancellation of orders?
Our biggest customers have been very supportive. And this is something which I am truly appreciative. They are giving us time to resolve with the condition that we keep them appraised. And we speak to them on a regular basis now. Every week, my sustainability team and I keep them updated on the things that we are doing because, you know, for them, it is also impacting on their operation. And I can fully understand where they're coming from. But the fact that they are not taking a blanket order or blanket decision to just ban Siam Dabi Plantation, for me, is a big relief. And I think it speaks volume about the kind of relationship and trust that we have built with them over the years.
Now, Haris, when we take a look at downstream activities, they're generally looked as a way of going higher up the value chain and moving away from pure extraction activities. Haris, how wide is your downstream business? Could you give us some color here?
So in terms of capacities, we have around 3.9 million tons of refining capacities between Southeast Asia, Europe and South Africa. We have around 612,000 tons of crushing capacity where we crush soya, copra in Papua New Guinea, palm kernel oil. And we also have a biodiesel plant in Malaysia. And today that capacity is 126,000 metric ton. So that's sort of the capacities that we have. And with regards to footprint, around 43% of that capacity are actually in Malaysia. So you can then say that actually most of our capacity is actually outside of Malaysia. We have a refinery in Indonesia, two refineries in Europe, one in South Africa. We have two in Thailand, one refinery in Papua New Guinea, and copper crushing facilities also in Papua New Guinea. So that's sort of the breadth of operations that we have. And in terms of sort of the the business that we do, today, of that 3.9 million tons of refining capacity that we have, about 1.8 million tons is still considered to be bulk. And this is quite different to the other part of the business that we do, which we call the differentiated business. And today, there's about 2.1 million tons of capacity. And these are two different types of business that we run. So the bulk commodities purely talk about price, talks about volume, it's about supply chain. How quickly can I get my products from Asia into markets like India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, and even to Europe? And we move this oil or these products in vessel loads, 45,000-ton vessel sail across from Asia to the destination countries. That's high volume, low margin, but one where we could actually be quite successful if we can sort out not just the supply chain, but the pricing part of it. And here I'm referring to trading. How good are we in capturing the market movement and timing the buy and the sell, so to speak? And that remains a big chunk of our operations today. And I think that's a competency that we have developed over the years, and we're not going to lose that. Going forward, however, the focus is more on this high margin product and hence this differentiated capacities that we have. This is dealing with food manufacturers. These are customers that demand a certain service level, a certain product offering, and perhaps of a higher quality. Much more complicated to manage, requires a lot of effort and resources. You're dealing with hundreds of customers with all kinds of demands and specification, but this is more stable in a sense that your margin it doesn't really sway that much. And once you have these customers in your book, they tend to stick with you for a long time. So balancing these two is very important because whilst we can make a lot of money if we get the market right in a timely run on the bulk side of the business, there's always that risk of you losing money if you don't time the market, if you time your activities right.
Up next, we discuss financials, including the potential impact of MCO 2.0, as well as a look at their gross margins. Keep it here to The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kunnison. This morning, I'm speaking with Haris Arshad, Managing Director of Sime Dabi Oils, the downstream arm of Sime Dabi Plantations. Now, Haris, before we get into some of the numbers, when it comes to your customer base, could you give us some examples of maybe some of your major bulk customers or some of your major differentiated capacity customers?
Yeah. Our biggest market for bulk is India. And our customers in India are mostly food manufacturers themselves, or they have refiners themselves who then sell on their processed oil to food manufacturers. So we don't deal with the food manufacturers in India or in Pakistan or in China. For the differentiated part, we have customers, and these are the names that you know, Nestle, Unilever, Kellogg's, and some of the large manufacturers here in Malaysia. Ramly Burger, for example, is a very big and important customer of ours. We've been dealing with them for a long time. So those are sort of the type of customers that we have under the differentiated portfolio.
What's the breakdown between Asia-Pacific, Europe, and Africa?
Asia-Pacific remains sort of our biggest footprint. So if I were to sort of split it, I would say Asia is about 70% of what we do today. Around 30% is Europe and Africa.
Now, let's talk a bit about the numbers here, Haris. Despite the pandemic, revenue from downstream for the first 9 months of 2020 grew 12% on year to 7.5 billion ringgit. Was this from increased demand or better selling margins?
Demand actually saw a decline, Roshan, in 2020. So we do have a full year number now. Unfortunately, I can't give you too much details. Mm-hmm. But what I can say is that volume actually saw a decline for SDO. Margins actually didn't do so well either versus 2019. So in other words, I didn't really see a huge growth in GP, yeah, or in margin in 2020 versus 2019. But what has really helped us is the fact that we were able to time our activities well. In other words, the moment that we buy our feedstock and the time that we sell our products, and the way that the market moves has enabled us to actually stretch that that margin. And this is precisely what we do in SDO. The market itself doesn't necessarily give you fantastic margin if you are to do what we call a back-to-back transaction. You have to be able to actually time the market right. You got to find moments where you need to procure your feedstock and the time for when you actually sell your products. And if you can't find those two things happening at the same time, we have what we call hedging, right? Or managing our price risk. And that's something that we've developed over the years. And I think we are probably quite comfortable in the way that we manage our prices exposure. And this has helped us to actually deliver consistent numbers over the years, despite volume volatility and to some extent margin volatility.
Right. So it's essentially trading revenue or trading income that supplemented your earnings for 2020.
That's right. That's right. And trading should not be seen as a separate activity. It underpins basically our manufacturing and our commercial activities. If you do not have a strong trading setup, you are not going to be able to withstand the pressure that we feel as a downstream entity. And let me give you a real example today. If you look at the margin structure for a Malaysian refiner, and you compare that to an Indonesian refiner, the Indonesian refiners are actually winning hand over fist. And that's primarily because the levy structure that is now in place in Indonesia sort of guarantees a certain margin for them, whereas we don't have that. So this is unique to Indonesia, and why they have this is basically they want to actually have a fund that they can use to manage to pay for their biodiesel program. And the result of that is sort of like a structural advantage to their downstream refiners. And we're finding it very, very difficult to compete with the Indonesian refiners today on a back-to-back basis.
Right. And this is specifically for Indonesian refiners as opposed to those operating like yourselves in Indonesia?
No, we benefit from that as well. But out of that 3.9 million tons capacity, only 800,000 tons is in Indonesia. Right? So the rest of it is outside of Indonesia, Malaysia, Europe, and Africa. And because of the proximity between Malaysia and Indonesia, our refineries in Malaysia actually compete head-on with Indonesia. Right? So this is where, unless we have the ability to create this market, it's actually quite difficult for us to compete with the Indonesians right now.
Yeah, because if I take a look at from a profitability perspective, Haris, operating profit from the downstream business fell for the first 9 months of 2020. And of course, these are the quarterly reports that I have with me at this juncture.
Right.
That fell about 10% on year to 180 million ringgit. And this looks to be on the back of lower margins in quarter two, which was, I mean, across the board, people were hit in quarter two. We're in another MCO, Haris, and which will be expanded for the rest of the country except for Sarawak beginning the 22nd. How sensitive are you to local demand?
We were quite surprised, Roshan. Why am I saying that? It's because, by and large, food demand wasn't really impacted. Well, at least the kind of customers that we are dealing with, we didn't see any impact. Our customers are actually reporting good sales throughout 2020, and we're not seeing sort of people tightening up, and people are still eating the same. And given the fact that we are actually providing ingredients for them to produce their products, we sort of had this sort of tailwind, right? In the sense that despite all the adversities we see, all the uncertainties, people continue to actually eat. And this actually has helped us to at least maintain our operation. So going into MCO 2.0, I do not expect this to be any worse than where we were in quarter one last year.
But that's it, Haris. When we take a look at the overall business, I guess, while Q3 saw a return to pre-pandemic operating profit, gross margins for downstream are tiny, Haris. For the 9 months of 2020, it was 2.4% from the 3% the year before. I guess my question here is, why isn't downstream more profitable if the aim is to go up the value chain?
It's the commodity business that we're in typically generates a margin of about 4-5% in a fantastic year. It doesn't go beyond that. And this is standard across the industry. If you're in manufacturing, commodity manufacturing, that's the sort of margin that you would get. So it doesn't really run away from that. Which then sort of begs the question, what are we going to do, right? So what should Sam W Oils do going forward? You know, that's not the kind of margin that we want to operate in forever. So given the backdrop, that's why when you look at SDO, one of the things that we talk about is to pivot away from just being a commodity refiner or oils and fats manufacturer into one that goes further downstream. And that's where you ought to see margins going from 4-5% to one which is double digit.
Haris, let's wrap up this conversation by talking a little bit about the long-term direction in the group, from the group itself. Do you have any target financial contributions from the board? What are they expecting?
Well, the board is worried that as a plantation company, the ability to grow is limited. There's no more land bank expansion, and even if there is, we have a very strong no deforestation policy, and that limits what we can do. So if SDP is to grow, it has to grow through downstream, and growth has to come from this particular area of the business. Now, we have proven that over the last 6 years, we have shown consistent, despite volatile market, consistent growth in the downstream sector. So we've actually embarked on an enterprise-wide transformation in SDO, where we call it Project Matterhorn. And the aim of this project is to double our profit from our 2019 baseline. And this is done through organic growth, as well as capacity expansion on our existing business. And so in that project, we're looking at how can we produce more, increase our capacity throughput. So we call it manufacturing excellence. How can we improve our margin mix? That is commercial excellence. Some of the things that I talked earlier is part of that agenda under commercial and trading and risk management. And I can't emphasize enough how important it is for us to have strong trading and price risk management capability. So we actually want to build on that. So these three things sort of make up this three-legged stool for downstream to grow for SDP. Post that. So if you are successful in delivering on Project Matterhorn, then sort of it gives us the opportunity to look at adjacencies or strategic partnership. Because the longer term objective for us, for SDO as well as STP, is to move beyond oils and fats refining and manufacturing and really pivot towards really high value activities.
Haris, let's end on this note then. Speaking about the long term, have there been any talks about an IPO in the long term future for SDO?
We took a cursory look around what opportunities are there, what options we can take. But you know, when you talk about IPO, it must make sense. Why do you want to go for IPO? What's the benefit in doing so? But the one thing we do not want to lose is this integration between upstream and downstream, because I think that is like the secret sauce, if you like. Mm-hmm. For the success of SDO. So yeah, many things are possible, but I think it's a bit too early to think about what the next step would be beyond trying to get this Project Matterhorn off to a start.
All right, Haris, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Welcome. Thanks for having me, Roshan. It's been a pleasure.
I was speaking with Haris Arshad, Managing Director of Sime Darby Oils, and you've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Gunnison for BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.